Hello, my name's Joss and I'm an addict.
Joss.
It's an honour and a privilege to be asked to come and talk here today. I'll tell you a little bit about my using and what brought me to this fellowship. I started using drugs at the age of about 11 years old. Just the normal types of drugs, really, you know, just smoking a bit of puff and It escalated pretty quickly for me. By the age of sort of 15, 16, I got introduced into the house music scene and into clubbing and parties. And you know, I'm not here to say that it wasn't fun, because it was fun. I had an awful amount of fun. I had fantastic times. I wouldn't change that for the world, but that's not the way that it ended up. It became problematic pretty much from the beginning. I believe that I had an appetite more than everybody else, I believe. You know, like I had that gold ticket for the Canaan's Club. I could go further, I could go longer. And I was pretty proud of it. I thought to myself, if it was an Olympic sport, then it was, you know, I was going to win it, definitely. For staying up for days on end, it was something that I was really good at. But that just carried on, you know. Everybody around me grew up. Everybody else got families. Everyone else had children. And I just carried on doing the same thing. I just stuck in this revolving door of doing the same thing. And then I got a bit further on in my life and my partner had a child, and I still carried on within the house music industry, and now I was DJing, and it went hand in hand. DJing and running parties is a really good excuse to use a lot of drugs, because that's what DJs do. That's what we all do. And I thought that was fine. But the difference with me was I just didn't know when to stop. And more to the fact, I couldn't stop. It would go on for days and weeks. And lots of funny stories would come out of that. But the reality of it is, and the truth, and the bare truth is, it wasn't nice. It wasn't nice. It always started out nice, and it always started out that it was going to be different this time. I was going to use, I was going to have fun, and I'd be like a normal civilian, and I'd get home, and I'd go to bed, and everything would be fine. But I couldn't do that. I physically couldn't do that. As soon as I put a drug into my body, I just had a hunger for it that I couldn't control. And as I say, it would go on for weeks on end at times, weeks on end. There'd be brief intervals where I could control it. I'd decide that it was time for a break. I'd stop for a while, and then it could be. It was like I could only describe it as a time bomb. I'd never know when it was going to get me, and I used to describe it as it. I didn't know it. Something was going to get me. I could be popping out on a Tuesday afternoon. It could be raining. That would be a great excuse to go and have a drink. And I'd pop in for a drink and think that. And don't get me wrong, sometimes I could get away with that. The circumstances would change and I could maybe would have that drink and I'd go home. But I couldn't guarantee it. I couldn't guarantee you that where it was going to end, that one drink would always turn into. It would sometimes turn into a massive bender that was completely out of control. And I'd travel around the country trying to find more people and more drugs, and It was an existence, is what it was. And then a catalogue of letting people down, a catalogue of being unreliable, a catalogue. On the surface of it, near the end, I just about had everything. I just about still had a house. I just about still had a partner. I just really, skin of my teeth, I still had a job. And luckily, I had some understanding people around me. It got to a point where, not I wanted it to do. Wanted to do it. That wasn't the case for me. I didn't want to come and start going into these rooms. What I wanted was I wanted to be able to use normally. So I went down the classic route, and I went and saw my GP. I had some private health cover, and I went and sought help through psychiatry, which at first I thought to myself, yeah, this is what I needed to do, talk about lots of stuff that happened to me. But I would only tell the psychiatrist what they wanted to hear. I wouldn't tell them that I used drugs on a regular basis in high amounts. That wasn't what I was telling them. I was telling them that I just wanted to calm down a bit, which is what they tried to do for me. Then after yet another massive blowout and yet another situation where I'm sitting with my head in my hands, and I said to my partner, and she said, well, you need to go back to this, see the psychiatrist. And this psychiatrist told me that I needed to go into a rehab centre, so which I did, and I wasn't very happy about it, but I went and did that. And the reality of all of it is, and the whole story is, that the rehab centre, all the money and the time and the effort that I spent trying to get there, the only thing that has ever done anything for me is exactly in this room today, and that's, I don't make it up, this is the truth, this is actually what happened. I got introduced to 12-step fellowships, and as a few people have spoken about today, and I'm sure a few more will, I went in there and I didn't get a message. I got a message of, if you keep coming back. So I kept coming back, and guess what? You know, I went out there and I used again, and I found myself back again in the same situation. And then divine intervention, call it what you want, I don't know, but I went to this meeting back after another relapse, after another, with my tail between my legs again, promising everybody again. And there was somebody sitting up here like I am today, not with a microphone, but they were sitting up here like this. And they had the information. And I looked at what this, and listened, more looked and listened really. I could see that this guy, he had something. He wasn't sick like everybody else. He wasn't moaning about his day. He wasn't glorifying his using. He wasn't telling me a big long story about how many drugs he used and how exciting it was and how terrible it was. He was telling me about what he's done about his problem. And my ears pricked up. And at the end of the meeting, this guy came over to me and offered me his telephone number, which is something that was new to me. You know, I could scurry off and have a cigarette and I could probably get away with not speaking to anybody, getting in the car and driving home. But this guy came over and spoke to me and gave me his telephone number. A few days later, I thought, you know, I'd sort of got this wishy-washy message of sponsorship. And I didn't. I'd bought lots of books and lots of well-meaning books, and I'd looked at them, and they meant nothing to me, really. I looked at them, and it made no sense at all. But I went to this guy, and I thought, you know, he's given me his telephone number. I'm gonna make that step. I'm gonna ask him. So I asked him. I rang him up and said, "Would you sponsor me?" The guy instantly says, "Yes, I'll sponsor you." And to be honest with you, that's really the end of the story, because from that point onwards, he gave me some simple, very, very simple things to do that I believe all of us in this room do exactly the same stuff. There's no maybe you can do this and maybe you can do that. Just do this. It's simple, which is what I did. He gave me some simple suggestions. And there was the God part of it came in, you know. And I'm not the sort of fellow who goes to church and gets on his knees. I'm not a God-y person. But I thought, I'm desperate enough, and this guy seems to have something that I want. So I followed what he said to do, and I got down on my knees, and it didn't feel right. No, it didn't, getting down on my knees. I sort of hid myself away and got down and said these prayers, but followed these suggestions that he told me to do. And as I say, I don't make this stuff up. My obsession that I'd had for 15 years of wanting to use drugs, don't get me wrong, I will always think about drugs. I'm a drug addict. They always come into my head. I can't stop them coming into my head. But I do not obsess about using drugs. And that, for no, tick number one, that's a miracle. That's the first miracle. Now, if I hadn't have had that, if that hadn't happened to me, I don't know if I could have carried it on. If I hadn't have had some answers straight away, like I've had, then I wouldn't have carried on with the rest of the work. But I did. I did get those answers. So, and then I quickly realised that it wasn't, me not using drugs was not the only problem. And because I had some well-educated people around me about this disease that we've got, I was learning, and I was taught about it. I was taught about what is wrong with me. And it carried on from there. We went, you know, we started working through the steps. We got step three, and I didn't even realise that I had a temporary sponsor. But he asked me, "Would you like me to be a sponsor?" I said, "Yes." We carried on. I've been all the way through the work now, and it's been, it's been a revelation. I mean, the people who are in my home group have seen the change in me, and it's, as I say to anybody who will ask me that, and a lot of people say the same. If you want to know how it's worked, then you just speak to my partner, because she'll tell you the changes in my life are not dramatic. They're amazing. I'm a living testament to it, an absolute living testament. I don't use drugs. Two, I can pull myself up when I'm being a right selfish bastard, you know? Excuse my language. But I've got those tools now to deal with it. I can deal with life on life's terms, and for that I'll be eternally grateful. That the things I've got going on in my life, that I used to hear people saying my life is on fire. Now, the idea when I was using of my life being on fire when I wasn't using drugs, that was a crazy thing for somebody to say. I thought a life without drugs would be a seriously boring. You'd walk around with a big grey cloud above your head. That's not the case. That really isn't the case, and I can't stress it enough. I'm just at the beginning of my life. I feel like this just started. I've just kicked off, and what lies ahead of me is, I'm excited. I've got a future, a real future that doesn't go week to week and day to day. My future, I'm looking out ahead and I can see the next 50, 60 years. And I never thought I'd see that. And that's purely through just shutting my mouth, listening to my sponsor and getting on with this program. And it's pure and simple as that. And I will leave it there. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Josh. And now I hand you over to Simon, who has been invited to share for us today. Thank you.
Thanks, Manu. I'm Simon. I'm a very grateful recovered addict.
All right, Simon.
How cool is this? Seriously, though, just seeing everybody here today. I mean, I'm sat here now with an immense feeling of gratitude for what we've done here. Thanks to the guys from Sweden. Thanks for the direction we've got from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thanks to my sponsor. Thanks to his sponsor, and so on, ad infinitum. I've got an amazingly cool life. It's so cool to be here and experience this. That wasn't always the case, as I'm sure most of you in here will identify with. I'm the kind of guy that goes out in the morning for one and comes home 3 weeks later with a criminal record. I'm the kind of guy that goes to hospital after overdosing and being in a coma for 13 days and thinks it's the most natural thing in the world the day he leaves to go and take the same substance that put him in there. That's the kind of guy I am. It's funny, I shared this in my own group a while ago. Me and my partner, we were seeing our boy off. The summer holidays had just started, and he's going out, and my partner's fussing over him. Are you going to be all right? What are you going to do? And all the rest of it. Now, I remember being a kid, my parents would be kicking me out the door, is what they'd be doing, and I'd go out, and they wouldn't hear from me for the rest of the day, and I'd come home at tea time, because that's what you did, at 5 o'clock. More often than not, with the dirty clothes, a rip somewhere, hungry and smelling of fire. Now, fast forward 25, 30 years, and I'd be living at my mum's house still, because I was gangster, I was, in a room at my parents' house, and I'd tell her I was going out, and probably I'd come back 2 weeks later, hungry, with a tooth missing, rips in my clothes and still smelling of fire. But I didn't get that. I couldn't equate the fact that the attitude that I had was exactly the same as the one that I had when I was a kid. I couldn't do that. I mean, a lot of guys have shared today, I use exactly like you do. I have completely no power over the amount of chemicals that I put inside my body once I take one. I never understood that. I always thought it was the chemicals that I used that was the problem that I had. I always equated the drama that came along with that as the root of the problem that I had. I didn't understand. I didn't know any different. And you know what? It was just the way it was. I didn't know any different. This was the thing you hear people talk about, oh, when I was a kid, I was just a kid. I didn't know any different. You know, I mixed and then I wouldn't and then I would. And that's just what my life was like until that great day when, you know, it was so stereotypical in school, bike sheds, somebody's got a bit of wacky backy, it's what they've got, and we're doing this, do you want some? Oh, okay. Didn't have to think about it, did it, and I realised that it did something for me. And what I found was, as I grew up, I mean, I was never aware of any kind of great spiritual malady, and, you know, you hear people say, oh, I felt separate as a kid, and yeah, I kind of did, but you know, didn't all kids? That's the way I used to think. And what I did find though is that as I was growing up, I found that the guys that I was knocking around with used to do stuff with increasing ease compared to what I used to do. I used to look at these guys and the way they would communicate with people and their personal relationships more than anything, and I'll think, how do you do that? and you know, Steve mentioned it earlier on, it would take me to use a chemical to be able to do stuff that I saw my friends doing with really relative ease when they weren't. Still didn't equate that as being a problem. Still didn't get that. Used drugs for 15, 20 years, whatever. Much the same way Erica said, do you want some of this? Yes, I do. How much do you have? That's the way I use chemicals. Didn't care. I remember one time, and I know the drama's not important, we managed to get out of a midwife's case, is what we did, and I remember sit down systematically going through every drug in this book. What's this? Don't know. Let's try. What's this? Don't know. Don't try. And that was my attitude towards chemical. I didn't realise that I had this voracious attitude that I was mentally incapable of stopping. I didn't know that. There were periods in my life where I stopped. I'd meet a set of consequences. I'd run into the local magistrate or something to do with social services around my son, or my parents would threaten to chuck me out, and I would manage to stop, and I would make all the resolutions, and I would, but never a decision. I would make all the promises, and I'd stop, and life would go great, and I'd get onto some college courses, what I would do, and then it'd get boring, and then the way my missus breathed would really get on my nerves, and then I'd look at her. And then Julian Sponsor talks about it. You know, that little voice, you could probably smoke a joint. That, or you've done really well, you could probably just have one. And that, and I'd be off. Or not, I'd be walking down the street, and I'd be just walking down the street, and I'd see somebody who I knew that I used with. All right, and I'm gone. It really was as simple as that. This went on ad infinitum for 15 years, something like that. Another set of consequences, another promise made, I'll clean up. This time I went into a facility. Is what I did. And I think it was Erica mentioned it earlier on, or somebody else mentioned it. I thought, I'll get this out of the way, I'll just clean up, and I'll go about and live my life. And in there, I was told I was powerless. Is what, and I had no clue what these guys were talking about, and I didn't relate. And they're all talking about some really horrific stuff that went on in their life, and the best I could come up with in my head was, my dad never bought me a Mr. Frosty machine. That was the extent of the drama that happened in my life. I grew up in a really normal, okay family. Will you give me that 5 minutes then? Get out. Anyway, came out of this facility, moved to a new area. Life was great. Ego was fully intact. I'd put a couple of stone on. I had some teeth put back in my head. That's what I did. Then I got introduced to women who had their own teeth, which was a novel. Which was great, which was brilliant, and kind of fitted right into the fellowship that I went into, because I was stark raving mad. I had no conception of what being powerless was. I had no conception of what being an addict was. Somebody mentioned it earlier on. I was clever enough to understand that drugs were problematic in my life, and that once I started, I found it really, really difficult to stop. I got that. I kind of got that. And then went off and got all the things that I thought I deserved, because I had a really hard life and enjoyed the pats on the back and all the rest of it, and proceeded to do that and made a very good job of it too. But that familiar feeling kind of started to come back, and I kind of did what I always did. And, you know, I did the only thing I knew how to deal with that, and that was try to shrug it off, or buy myself something different, or text another woman, or this, or that. And these things worked periodically. But then they started to fade. And I remember being sat in my flat. I'd created myself my own business. I had a partner I was very much in love with. I had a lovely flat. It was all full of really nice, shiny things. I'd been going to this fellowship, and everybody there thought I was great, because I'd learnt their book inside and out, and I was able to reel it off and say this and all the rest of it, and come out with the funny one-liners and make people laugh and tell you my boring stories again, is what I would do. And I'd tell you to keep coming back. I wouldn't go that often, but because I'd been there for a year and a half. I was an old-timer. I was. I'd do that, and I'd share about what was going on. And then the guy who had us a sponsor that time, he'd been around for a long time in that fellowship. And now, don't misunderstand me. You know, I don't bear any malice at all to what's happened. Plenty of times do I sit down at the end of the night and I write these people on my gratitude list, because if it wasn't for the experience that I had there, I don't believe I would have reached the place that I've reached now. I don't. I remember a week before I finally got good sponsorship, I asked some other guy in the same fellowship if he would sponsor me, and he turned me down because he had his daughter coming down over Christmas and he was all a bit busy and all the rest of it. And I remember, you know, I didn't know any different at the time. That's what happened around me, but I'm so grateful to that man for not taking me under. I'm so grateful for that man for not sponsoring me. I reached a point in my life where fear was a constant companion. Fear, I was unable to manage my emotional nature. I was just scared all the time, man. You know, all the time. I was just wondering what you were doing, what you were thinking about me. Stuart comes up with a brilliant story. He's walking down the road and somebody will be looking at him and they'll think I'm walking funny. And then I'll try and start not to walk funny. And then I'm walking even more mad funny. I identify with that. I'd walk downtown and see somebody with a clipboard from a charity or whatever. And I'm 300 yards up the road and I'm plotting what I can say if I get stopped, how I can not get stopped by them. This is a constant thought for me, and I'm thinking this is not good. And I hear you guys talk about suicidal thoughts. Now, I never thought I had them, but more often than not, I drive down to Plymouth for meetings or whatnot, and I'd have this crazy thought: I wonder what'd happen if I just went like that into the side of the world. This. Now, if that's not a suicidal thought, I don't know what is. And I reached a point in my life where I knew I was done. I had this very brief moment, and that's what it was. And I knew I had to capitalise on it. And in that moment, I could clearly see what my life was, and that every problem I had, I was sitting at the front of the queue creating it. I could see that it was me. I could realise that all the resentments I had, all the bitterness that I had, was ultimately killing me. I knew that's what I want, and I knew I had to do something drastic. And doing something drastic for me is taking on board suggestions from somebody else and actually going through with them. We are said often a lot in my group, I'm not one of these people, and I don't identify, I'm never asked for help. You know what I mean? If I didn't ask for help, I wouldn't have a flat, I wouldn't have had a script, I wouldn't have had all of these things. I was good at asking for that, but I never, you know, I'd sit down and I'd nod at you and I'd be thinking, well, I'm going to go and school in a minute, or I wonder what she's doing later on. And I'm listening to you intently is what I'm doing. Went to this meeting, shared about it a little bit earlier on. And still being in that kind of mindset of the fellowship that I was in, it was like I was in some kind of MK Ultra CIA thing. I'd been brainwashed. And Stuart, member of my own group, he was the share finder of this meeting at the time, and he said to me, "Will you do the share?" And I'm in a place of step one. And of course, I'm still in this mindset of, yeah, that's what I'll do it. Yeah, all right. I'll just talk about it. That'll make everything okay. So I've sat down and I've just talked nonsense for however long I did. And in that room that night was my sponsor. And all he simply did was share his story. It's what he did. And I'm sat at that table and I've listened to it and I thought, I'm doomed. I'm doomed. With that, after I didn't go and ask him because I had the right hump with him. I had the right hump with him. So I went and asked some other guy, and by an act of providence, call it whatever you like, this guy responded at the big book, and he sat down and he qualified me, and he asked me the questions. He said, if we're using, do you obsess, what's your life like, what's your personal relationship like? We had this really informal kind of conversations, and I just said, "That's yes, yes, yes." And he asked me that question, are you willing to go to any lengths? I didn't know what that meant, but I said yes, because I was afraid. I said, yes, I did, because I meant it. And not only did I mean it, more importantly, he meant it as well. He wasn't going to stand up for any of my nonsense is what he was going to do. I went on that night, I put into action the suggestions this guy gave to me, and I had this just the most amazing feeling. I had this kind of light shine on me for the first time in my life, and I felt like I've been saved. This is what's happened. And I remember ringing my sponsor up the next day, and he's going, brilliant, fantastic. I said, this is great. You know, he said, yeah, okay. He said, what have you done today? I'm just phoning you. He said, no. He said, go away, do your suggestion. He said, phone me later on. That's what he did. And I've just kept doing that for the last 7 years, and I've got an amazingly wonderful life. I have such a simple life, and that's all I have to offer anybody. I'm still accountable to my sponsor. My sponsor told me in the very beginning that my life depends upon me trying to give this away to everybody else. My life, I don't do this because the sole purpose of me doing this isn't for me to have a fantastic life, it's so that I can help the next guy. As a result of doing what I do, I have an amazingly fantastic life. I'm somebody who you would not put your money on to be sat in this chair alive and well today. I'm not. I'm surrounded by people I've made lifelong friends. It's funny, Erica mentioned something about earlier on when she was going for her treatment. And once upon a time, I was surrounded by people that would have been, oh, It'd have been all like that. I've just finished a course of intensive treatment is what I've been, and I'm surrounded by my own group members, and they've been telling me, you look like you're dying. And I love that. And somebody like me needs my selfish and self-centred nature totally humiliated and smashed to the point where I'm able to see it myself in how ridiculous it actually is. And I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for that. This is the only place I've ever known I've got it. It's wonderful to be here. Joachim, thank you, and the guys from Sweden for coming over, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to share.